Hey, thanks for listening to our first ever episode of Scripts and Scribes Live, our new weekly live stream show. We'll be recording new episodes live on YouTube every Saturday, so be sure to follow us on YouTube and check out scriptsandscribes.com for all the info on future guests and times for our upcoming live streams. Every week we're going to be covering a different topic. This week was finding representation with Lit Manager Daniel Seco of Empirical Evidence. Coming right up. And this Saturday, February 27th at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, we'll be discussing Breaking into the TV Writer's Room with TV writer, producer, and showrunner Paul Guyot of NCIS New Orleans and Leverage, and TV writer Brendan Gallagher of Netflix's Warrior Nun. So stop by to join in on the conversation, as we will have a Q&A session in every episode for you all. On a side note, this being our first episode, we did have a few technical issues, such as my slightly low audio. Apologies in advance. Hopefully we'll get everything worked out before the second episode. And the episode does have an abrupt ending, as I had a power outage that basically ended the live stream suddenly in the middle of a question, so don't be surprised when it just cuts off. We'll try to do better next time. So thank you for listening and enjoy the show. Welcome to the first Scripts and Scribes live stream show, our first ever, as you can probably tell from all the technical issues we've had, but we're working now, and thank you for sticking with us. Our guest today is a lit manager and producer who has worked at Netflix and at agency CAA and Resolution. His managerial experience includes stints at Writ Large and Schemers, and now he's recently teamed up with Derek Epic at Empirical Evidence, where he represents working and up-and-coming writers and directors for film and television. He's one of the most patient, apparently, and generous, congenial dudes you'll ever meet, Daniel Seco. Thank you for joining us, Dan.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
And one of our wonderful mods from our Scripts and Scribes Discord, if you haven't checked it out yet, you should come visit and say hi. Catherine Burgess, thank you for joining us today, Catherine. And so we're going to talk about a few topics about the industry and some general lit questions, and then we're going to open it up to questions from the audience right now in the chat. So we'll do that in just a few minutes. But first, we'll get started just by saying hey to our guest today. Dan, how are you?
Doing well. Hanging in there, you know. Ready to get my vaccine, not to get political, but, you know, same shit, different day.
I don't know why the vaccine is political. I really don't, but, you know, that's maybe above my pay grade. So, so I want to start off, this is our first live stream, and I sort of want to start off with sort of industry topics, since we're going to be doing it on a weekly basis, which you should check out. If you're interested in being a TV writer, you should check out our episode next week as well. We're going to be doing a special with a couple, with a showrunner and a TV writer on breaking into the writer's room. But today it's all about management. It's all about representation. But we want to start off with a few news topics. There's not too much going on this week, I don't think. But I know a couple weeks ago, the WGA and WME signed, the last agency holdout, signed the pact to allow agencies, now all agencies, can represent writers and directors. But I wanted to ask you, Dan, how does that affect the business for writers and directors, and how does that affect your business in particular?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think a lot of my clients have kind of asked me about that, and I've spoken to other managers about it. I mean, for me in particular, doesn't really change the day to day. I mean, whether it's legal or not, most of the deals I do, if the writer doesn't have an agent, we usually get a lawyer involved. Not to diminish agents in any way, because a lot of them are super talented, but they're not always the most helpful people. You know, they can get things done in some respects, but a lot of it, in just the general sense, is motivating them to do anything. So for me, like, I don't really care. Like, it doesn't make my life easier. It doesn't change anything. Majority of my clients are not in the WGA. Derek has some clients that are. But I actually don't think we have any clients at WME, so it really makes no difference for me.
Mm-hmm. Now, before the pact was signed between the WGA and all the agencies, I know a lot of reps had more work on their plate, because you had to act as both manager and sort of as agent, both in the development side with your clients. And not to say that there's not some overlap, but having to carry the full load. Now that that is sort of taken off your plate, at least for some clients who may have agents, does that mean you have more time to either focus on your current clients, or is there more time to possibly read new material for newer clients and that kind of thing? And just, well, you know, from what you've heard around.
Yeah, look, from my experience, having worked at two agencies, having a lot of the mindset of what an agent does, I love that side of the business. So I like taking my clients' projects out. To me, it's like I like being almost half manager, half agent. So like even when something is ready to go out and say the client does have an agent, I like doing submissions. I like shopping projects around. It brings me joy. So I would imagine there are plenty of managers out there that don't like to do that side of things. And so now, you know, yeah, maybe they may have more time to focus on development. But as much as I love development, I love selling. So I'm never going to change, even if the rules say, oh, now let the agents do it, I'm still going to take projects out and try to get, you know, things going and working in concert with the agencies when clients have dual representation.
Right. And you had mentioned at the start of the podcast about vaccine and COVID numbers, especially here in Los Angeles, where they were peaking just a month ago, have been dropping steadily. I know productions are starting to resume. I know a lot of people going back to work. In terms of development and production that you're aware of, up until now, again, many writers' rooms and meetings have been done via Zoom and things. How soon do you see this changing and going back to in-person meetings? Because I know a lot of writers are in Los Angeles. You know, a lot of writers start off in their hometown, wherever that may be. So now it's a good time to sort of seek it out because there's no in-person meetings or few in-person meetings. How soon do you see that sort of returning where it's people go back to that and productions start to resume at a frantic pace?
Sure. I mean, I assume I'll be proven wrong in a few months, but if I had to guess, I'd like to think the fall. Mm-hmm. Just if we can say that like the majority of people who'd want a vaccine would get it by the end of the summer. And then starting to feel comfortable about things. Look, I know people that are certainly doing in-person meetings at this point. I'm not. I wouldn't. Just right. Not my approach to how to stay safe. I know productions are ramping up both domestically and even more so international. But yeah, I would say Q4 of 2021 is maybe the closest we would get to before times. But maybe more realistically, it's next year. I don't have any interest or hopefulness that like I need to be doing in-person meetings. Zoom is fine. Phone calls are fine. Emails are fine. I feel like I've been more effective not having to waste my time commuting to places. Things that took 2 hours over coffee can be done in 20 minutes over a Zoom. So, I mean, that's just me. It's nice to see people in person, but I don't feel like I have to do it for the sake of that's the best business practice.
Right. And so for you, since you've had such a good experience with Zoom and these sort of digital meetings, virtual meetings, I guess, is a better term. Do you see that going back to normal for you or how much? In other words, do you think you'll continue to do this for meetings as much as possible?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm based in downtown LA. You know, if people want to come downtown or the Arts District to grab coffee or have lunch, awesome. But like, if I don't have to go to Santa Monica or Beverly Hills, you know, like, I'm not setting 5 lunches a week or 10 coffees. It's just not the best use of my time. So I think it'll be a mix. I think for most people it would be a mix where, hey, if it makes sense that we can meet up and it's convenient, great. But if we could do it over Zoom and that's just the easiest path to getting something set and not playing the game. Because this is, I think, the most important thing. In the before times, there's a game of resetting. I mean, I think my record is maybe a year and a half of resetting a lunch that like I just didn't want to go to Brentwood or something like that. But now, like, I feel like people are more likely to, if you set a meeting the first time that you have that time set, it actually happens. So I think from that standpoint, it's easier to set something up and actually get it done.
Right.
So I think for that reason, it would be helpful to continue to use Zoom and other Google meetings and stuff like that, but mix it in when necessary to meet in person.
Right. That makes sense. Now, I think the reason a lot of people are here, other than you being a great guy and everyone loves Dan, is the fact that you're a lit manager, and that's sort of the first step. Actually, I shouldn't say the first step. Most people think it's the first step. You write a script and you look for a lit manager. There's probably a dozen steps before finishing your script and seeking out a lit manager. But okay, a lot of people are at the point where they're interested in looking for a lit manager. So this is sort of, if you haven't heard Dan, he's been on our podcast a number of times. You can listen to some of those episodes. They're great. Scriptsandscribes.com. But for those who haven't, so we can kind of just jump into it, let's get into our representation 101, put on our representation hats, and talk. Maybe you could answer just sort of in broad strokes for those listening who may not know. And if you do, it's just a refresher. What does a lit manager do, and what do you not do, and why do writers and filmmakers need you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think maybe a good starting point is kind of differentiating between what an agent does and what a manager does. Mm-hmm. If we really boil it down, I think an agent's going to focus more on the selling, setting up meetings, getting things across the finish line, more of a business approach, whereas a good literary manager, and I say that very deliberately,
right,
because there are many literary managers that are just agents in casual clothing.
Or producers, really.
Sure, yeah. And, you know, it's funny, you call me a producer. I wouldn't call myself a producer. You know, I think, like, being a producer, you have to be value-added. So I'm very reluctant to be called a producer. Hopefully down the road I can justify, you know, being a part of a project in that capacity. Mm-hmm. But I think for me as a literary manager, you know, why that position within the Hollywood ecosystem? I come from a journalism background. I was a sports writer, baseball, soccer, NBA. And beyond just being a writer, I was an editor. And so, like, what did I do as an editor? My goal was to make writers better. And I think that's kind of the mindset and the skill set that I try to take from that career experience and bring to being a literary manager. A lot of my focus is on development, working with writers on ideas and outlines and treatments and draft after draft. I read a lot and I give a lot of notes. That is the majority of my day-to-day, you know, beyond trying to find clients, send out projects, set up meetings, attend festivals, do podcasts, things of that nature. But I think the big difference is agents are business focused, managers are more creatively driven. But I think the best managers are a little bit of both. How can you be mindful of the creative and the business and kind of work with both sides at the same time? So I think for me is, you know, understanding how a client's idea or project fits within the landscape and putting them in the best position to succeed from there.
Mm-hmm. And expanding on that a little bit, I know listeners of Script Notes, John August's podcast, John August, granted, he came up in a different time, but he is sort of against managers. At least he has been in the past. I don't know where he stands currently, but I know in the past he's been, you don't need a manager, you just need an agent. Times have changed, I think. And can you explain to those writers out there why getting an agent before a manager is much more difficult than it was in the past, and why managers are necessary? I mean, you've mentioned it, but I mean, in terms of like what agents don't do that managers do.
Yeah, look, I think for me, I try to identify up and coming talent, not someone that's like, oh, I had the top script on the blacklist, or oh, I sold 50 million things. It's like, cool. There's going to be thousands of people that try to raise their hand to sign people like that. You know, I think if you're a raw talent where you have the ability that you're good enough to get signed, you're probably not going to be a priority for a good agent. And so I think the biggest thing to avoid for any writer or director looking for representation is to not be in the bottom 25% of anyone's client list, because realistically, especially at the bigger agencies, you're not going to get your phone calls and emails returned in a timely manner or at all. So I think the point of a manager for someone that is up and coming and raw and, you know, there's potential, but how do you realize that potential? I think that's the manager's job, because an agent's not going to give you the time, the energy, the bandwidth, or anything to get you there. The expectation is agents will become activated when you are literally bringing in money, and probably not before that. So, you know, what kind of people should be getting signed with an agent for the first time? Maybe you won Sundance with your first feature film that you wrote and directed. You know, that's probably the level. And I'm talking about like getting signed at like a UTA and above. So like a UTA, CA, and WME. There's a lot of people that are obsessed with, oh, I'm at a cocktail party. Where are you repped? Oh, CAA. It's like, cool. But like, what does your agent do for you?
Right.
I worked at CAA. I saw that firsthand. Plenty of very talented people that were preoccupied with the fact that they were repped at CAA, but they weren't doing anything to really advance the career. And I think that's what a good manager can do, is think strategically, both in terms of the short and long term. How do we get you there? How do we put you in a position so that the agencies actually give a fuck about you?
Right, right. I worked at CAA too, and I work on the talent side. But yeah, there were people, actors whose names you know, you've seen in things, who are on the bottom 25% that we didn't field many calls for and we didn't put many outgoing calls for. If a call happened to come in, we would obviously book them. But you're focused on your top 50% of your client list. That's that's most of your outgoing calls to try to book work. And that's just the way of it. But anyway, so you make good points.
But I mean, look, even for me at a boutique management company, I still focus the majority of my time on my top five, sure, six, seven clients, because I have to. Mm-hmm. You know, so like, as much as things on the management side are not like just about the money, it's still money at the end. It's still a business. It's still a job. I think managers can take more risks, can take people on a little bit earlier. Agencies are like 99.9% about the bottom line.
Sure.
So at that point, I get it. But it's also like, hey, you don't want to go down this path if you want to have a very short career.
Right. Right. Actually, I just had a conversation with another lit manager, Lee Stobie, and we talked about obviously the art, the passion for projects, but it, you know, being tempered with the financial side. It's a show business, and to make yourself more appealing to lit reps, understanding that there is a financial side. It's not just about how great a writer you are, but is this somebody that I can sell? Is this somebody that can bring in bucks? Is this someone that can make money for me? And once people understand that, it's not just about how great of a writer you are and the art, but that how do you make yourself as potentially lucrative appearing as a writer, then it's going to be, it's never easy. I don't want to say it's going to be easy, but it's going to be, you're going to have a leg up.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Just kind of build off of that. If you're repped at a bigger agency, their expectation is that you're going to be polished in all aspects of the industry. So not just good on the page, but know how to present yourself in meetings, know how to take notes from producers. And I think, like, you know, for me, there's clients that I take on that are super talented, but it's still a learning curve in terms of other aspects of the industry. And I put it upon myself, and Derek does as well. You know, we want to coach our clients so that, yeah, you may be great on the page, but how can you be excellent across the board? Mm-hmm. And then I think at that point, you know, as you advance, then it makes more sense to bring an agent on board. And there's no surprises, I think, is maybe the best way to put it. Like, oh, hey, you know, that script was great, but they shit the bed in the meeting. It's like, I can't ever put myself in that position where that's a response that I'm getting about a client in a meeting. It's just, you know, it's not just about them. It's about me. It's Derek, the other clients, the reputation of the company. There's a lot of things to kind of keep in mind.
Right. Absolutely. Now, okay, let's get to the part where we discuss signing with a lit manager. What are some of the best ways that newer writers can find and sign with or make themselves appealing to a lit manager to be a prospective client, and where, what, why, via what route have you found some of your more recent clients?
Sure. I mean, look, what is the most important thing? What does the script look like? Is it great? Right. If the script's not great, probably not interested. You know, I'm not gonna. You may be a great person and super cool and all those things, and maybe we can be friends, but if the writing isn't great, it's so hard. And I think, like, seeing how people react sometimes to like, why did you, you know, why don't you want to sign me? And it's like, you're writing things that have no market appeal. This is derivative, whatever. So, but let's frame it in a positive sense. I think I've mentioned in the past, you know, there's like a hierarchy in terms of how I prioritize potential clients. On the high end, it would be a producer or an agent, let's say, hey, great, we got a great writer looking for a manager. You guys should take a look. And we recently signed someone this week that's sold a lot of stuff, won some major contests, is making good money, mid six figures, we'll say. The agent sent him over and we met with him and we loved him and we signed him. And it's like, that's the ideal situation. Someone that's super talented, that's hungry, that, has a good relationship with an agent that we have a relationship with, and they're looking for someone to kind of take them to the next level. That gets me super excited. I would say just below that is like executives or producers saying, hey, read this, it's really good. We're going to do an open writing assignment with them. They don't have a manager. Check them out. Great. Below that would be Derek or myself. We'd be a judge in a contest. We kind of get like an early heads up on, which scripts are really good. Start to meet with people, sign them that way. Then there's like referrals from existing clients, which sometimes works. Some of my friends or writers that I wouldn't necessarily sign, but they would give me referrals and that's helpful. Found a lot of writers off the blacklist, not the end of the year list, but just going onto the website, reading scripts, finding log lines. And then below that, I would say there's the Stage 32, Roadmap Writers, Virtual Pitch Fest, randomly looking stuff up on contests, Coverfly. And then below that at the way, way bottom is an unsolicited query letter where it's like, okay, I think you can make a splash with a query if you personalize it. I've gotten ones that are like, hey, David. And it's like, fuck you. Like, come on. You're so lazy. Like, you think I give a shit? You're just making it so easy for me to say no. And then people hit me up on social media. Twitter's fine. Instagram, I wouldn't respond. The new thing I've seen on is Facebook. People will like comment on like one of my photos and I get an alert, like someone comment project. It's like, great, like awesome. And then I'd say way below that is LinkedIn, which it's not a thing in Hollywood in my mind.
Right. Okay. So those are some of the ways that you find and sign new clients. You had mentioned contests and fellowships. You'd mentioned some of them. What, including the blacklist and other ones, what are a few of the more prominent, obviously everyone knows Sundance, Nickel, Austin, those kinds of things. What are some of the contests, fellowships, and things that you generally take seriously, that you look at, and if they're placed highly, then...
I mean, it's funny, because I can't say I weigh Nickel or Austin, where I've been a judge for years, over anything else, because the reality is any contest is going to be crappy scripts that do really well, and there's going to be great scripts that don't. I think a lot of it is dependent on who the judge is. Are the judges getting paid? It's a variety of different things. To me, it's more about I want to find log lines that are intriguing to me, that fit with the brand of writer that I'd like to work. I mean, here's the thing. Here's the simplest thing. If I wouldn't watch it, I wouldn't want to work on it. Like that. It's as simple as that. Like, if it's something that I would pay money and go to the theater to watch during normal times, it's probably something that would excite me. But I'm also mindful of the business side of things, that certain things play better than other things. Like, if it's 1600s, war, it's probably too expensive. It's probably just a sample. I'm not interested in just samples at this point. I want to sign someone that has a script that is actionable, because the amount of work that it takes to replicate what is just a sample, it's a lot. Like, I want there to be immediacy, that I can activate this person's career and get them going very quickly. Otherwise, it's too much of an uphill battle and too long of a path towards monetizing a client, which sadly is a consideration that I have to make in terms of how I spend my time. Mm-hmm. My time is the most valuable resource that I have. And if I don't see someone having a chance of making money, you know, within a year, it's probably not the best fit.
Right. Now, you'd mentioned if somebody wins Sundance with their film or someone wins Nickel with their script, obviously you're going to get attention, you're going to have heat, you're going to be approached by a number of reps. But for those writers out there who aren't Sundance winners, they didn't win the Audience Award at Sundance this year, when does a writer know that they're ready for representation? At what point it's like, okay, my script, I think I'm ready. I'm in a position where I should start sending out email, query emails, or whatever it happens to be to try to get representation. Because a lot of writers, I think, do too soon. They do it. They finish a script and they're like, I'm ready to go. Let's make this into a movie.
Well, I'd say another way that like you're probably not ready is if you reach out and say that you have 20 scripts. That's the biggest red flag for me. You don't have 20 scripts. Ideally, you have like two or three things that are equally great or within the same stratosphere of really good. It's tough. There's no right or wrong answer, but yeah, I would say err on the side of waiting a bit. Don't go out prematurely. How can you be validated? Yes, contests, blacklists, things like that. You know, I think if you're in a writer's group and there's some really positive reactions, awesome. But it's tough. Like, I can't say that there is some kind of like, I don't know, like quantitative measure. If you get five great reads, then you're ready to go. It's like, it depends. I think it's feeling really good about what you have, reading other scripts that have sold to maybe give you a sense of, hey, are you on this level? That might be a kind of outside the box way. But again, it's not about 100 people raising their hand wanting to sign you, mm-hmm. but hopefully it's more than one. I think that's also, I think one of the biggest mistakes that up and coming writers make is signing with the first person that's interested in them. It's probably not the best fit. It could be, but I think getting a sense of the different managerial styles that people employ is super important. You know, the way I approach something, someone's career may rub someone the wrong way. There may be other managers out there that do things differently that are more in line with a writer's expectation. I would hope that they've taken enough meetings that they get a sense, okay, stylistically, Dan's the right fit, or Jeff Portnoy is the right fit, or whoever is the right fit. I don't know why I just plugged Jeff, but he can Venmo me after
Jeff.
This.
He's great.
You know, I just think it's different for everyone. Everyone's approach, everyone's path in is different. What's the best path if you could possibly get there? Be friends with people that matter. Be friends with executives. Be friends with agents. The validation from an executive or an agent saying your script is good is super helpful. Mm. I mean, if a friend of mine who I wouldn't rep sends me a script that's great, yeah, at that point, I would send it to other reps. It's a very rare occurrence that I send material to other reps, but that's a good example of someone I'm friendly with has a great script. I'm not going to sign them because we're friends. Great. I'll send it to managers A, B, and C. So like, I hate to say do this and it will work. Everyone's going to have a very different path towards success. There's no one best way to do it besides being great on the page.
Mm-hmm. And you had mentioned different styles because every manager is different, not just in terms of personality wise, but the way in which they work, the way in which they sort of break writers and help shepherd their career. And we've talked about it before, but maybe for this audience, what would you consider to be your style? Like, how do you work with newer writers, not existing clients per se, but newer writers breaking in? Like, you sign a new client, what's the first thing you do?
So you ever see Entourage?
Mm-hmm.
I'd say my stylings are like Scotty 24/7 Lavin, played by Scott Conn. But I would say that I'm hands-on. I'm very development-focused. I think about both the creative and the business side of things. But I would say this is the most important thing about my approach, is that it's different for every single client. There are many reps that I've seen firsthand be basically the exact same person for every client. And I don't think that that necessarily works. You know, if I have a 30-something female American client living abroad, how do I work with her versus a writer that went to the same school as me, that has the exact same interests as me, where we toe the line of manager client, but also being friends? It looks a little bit different. Like, I'm very mindful of, I don't want to be best friends with any of my clients because it just makes it more difficult than it needs to be. One of my clients who's a lawyer, he and I have a lot of similar interests. We talk about sports all the time. We had to have a very difficult conversation the other day, probably the most difficult that we've ever had. And I was very mindful to keep checking in with him as we had the conversation. Hey, are you okay? Can we go here? Like, and I think, you know, just the idea that maybe I let us get a little bit too close made that conversation harder than it needed to be. It's something I've been reflecting upon, and I think I'll be mindful of going forward. I think just being sure that I give each client what they need to be successful rather than what I think they need, like really checking in, having emotional intelligence about how I approach it. You know, I don't want to be hurtful. Like, I would say when I worked at Resolution and CAA, I was an asshole. Like, I didn't know what a shit sandwich was. I would just slam a script if it was terrible, right? Like, I didn't know how to be, hey, this worked. Let's work on this. And then, but this was good too. Like, I was not diplomatic. And I think I've been really aware of my success will be predicated on just being a decent human being. Everything else, I think I checked the right boxes, but I think just how I treat people is something I'm super mindful of. And I think it starts with how I treat my clients.
Right. No, that makes sense.
Like, just to, like, not toot my own horn, but I'm not going to go 2 weeks without responding to a client. I'm not going to ignore phone calls. I'm not going to ignore emails. Like, if I don't respond within 48 hours, I'm probably going to have a nightmare about it. Like, that's my mindset. I'd like to respond to people within 24 hours, really be, you know, if you're going to be my client, if I'm going to be your manager, then I'm going to do what I can to make you successful.
Right. And that is sort of a red flag, because you think, oh, well, they're my manager, they're my agent, whatever. They haven't responded to me in 2 weeks. That's a bad sign, but it does happen. And I'm not saying it's a good thing. It's a sign you probably need to seek new representation, or at least check on the welfare state of your your reps. But it does happen. And that's the kind of thing where you think it wouldn't. You think that they're your agent, but again, we talk about that bottom 25%, although that's probably even bottom 5%. There's always a client or two that you just don't have time for necessarily. Not that I'm a manager, but I, you know, obviously I've worked in an agency. So, and it's not a good situation. So the fact that, you know, there are managers like yourself, a handful that are so respectful to do that. I mean, it's one thing to get queries and not have time to respond to every single person, but it's a whole nother thing when your clients that you've signed, you don't respond to. So I do respect you for that. I mean, for other reasons as well. You're a great guy. But for that also, I think is a great thing, because not every manager is like that. Some managers, it's very black and white. It's very cut and dry. It's you know, anyway. Okay. So before we get to the open Q&A, our wonderful Maude from our Script Subscribes Discord, she's a college student in Virginia. Has done screenwriting, is working on a bunch of stuff. So I wanted to open it up to you, Kat, if you had a couple questions for David, because I'm sure there are many other college students who are watching or will be watching this at some point. What is your advice to Catherine? And Catherine, if you have any questions, please.
Well, circling back, you had mentioned that you did journalism. Was that you're in college that you majored in?
Yeah, so I started writing for the school newspaper at the University of Maryland and did pretty well. And I decided to go to journalism grad school at the University of Florida. I wrote for the paper there. I was on like a couple radio programs, but then I started my own soccer site covering the U.S. men's national team, which is the World Cup. And then we were credentialed by U.S. Soccer. I had a team of 10 writers. I sent writers to 2 World Cups. After I graduated, I did Teach for America for 2 years teaching special ed at a charter school in New Orleans. But it was after that that I resumed my writing career, covering Major League Baseball, the NBA, and then continuing to cover soccer. It was a mixture of like newspaper work and online.
Cool. Do you think that during in or not focusing on creative writing in school is beneficial to writers, so they're not pigeonholing themselves in this one certain area, like throughout their entire 4 years of school?
I don't know, because I can't say, right? Like for undergrad, I studied American studies, which is like a history major. I was a English major, and I guess like a media studies as well. So like I took a couple of film classes. I mean, look, like I didn't go to film school. What's my education? It's experience. It's reading thousands of scripts. Look, if you can go to an NYU, a USC, a UCLA, an AFI, and obviously other programs beyond that, awesome. I think you'll get some really great professors and things like that. But it may be more of just the brand name that will help you rather than what you actually learn in school, right? So like if you go to USC, it's probably easier to get an internship at CAA than it is to, like myself, go to the University of Maryland for undergrad. Like, no one gives a shit about Maryland, right? But USC, oh, wow, you know?
I can vouch for that, having gone to USC. One of my professors did get me an internship working at Fox. So yeah. I didn't even have to seek it out. She asked me if I wanted an internship at Fox. So I can vouch
for that. Like, the practical application of learning how to write, I think, is just by doing. Like, I don't necessarily believe that, oh, I'm like someone's a great writer because they went to film school. I think if you're learning a technical skill, like being a cinematographer, you know, that may make sense. But like even directing, I would say, is you may have the advantages of the resources of an NYU or a USC when it comes to making short films and stuff like that. But no, like I think there's so many paths that one could take. It may be more interesting that someone does like chemical engineering as their fucking undergrad degree rather than, oh, I studied creative writing. That being said, it's what you put into it that you get out of it. So I hate to say, oh, do this, do that. Everyone's path is different. Success can be found in many different ways.
All right. And then not entirely college related, but you mentioned your hierarchy of Twitter and where that falls in like queries. And what's interesting is I think that, and I don't know if it's just, it's probably just people show like praising on Twitter and like they put all the positive on Twitter, but more and more stories have come out of people like DMing managers and sending them a sample and getting signed. And you put it very low on your list of how to approach specifically yourself. And I was just wondering, like, if someone does approach you over social media, what do you think is the best way to go about it?
I would say be polite. Don't really have any expectations. Don't make demands. Don't be an asshole about it. Like, really just, you know, send a DM being like, hey, you know, we'd love to send you something. What's your policy for submission? You know, is there, if you can't hunt down an email address, I guess ask for it. I would say it was easier when I was at Schemers probably to find my email address because I was there for a while. You know, I think people could still probably find my empirical evidence email address without asking me. But like sometimes people are rude and they're like, they just make all, like, be considerate of my time. Like, I don't owe you shit. Like, what? Why do I owe you anything? And I think like that's something that's lost. Like, why do I have to read your script? It probably sucks. Like, because the reality is I'm passing on 99% of everything that I get. Why? That's the bar. Like, that is the bar. Like, and I, like, people don't realize it. It's like someone said it. Maybe it was like Danny Manis or someone like that. Like, maybe the reason why you aren't signed yet is because you're just not there yet, right? Maybe it's just not there yet on the page. Stop blaming other people. Stop complaining. Put in the work. You know, it's like, it's akin to being a professional athlete. So many people would love that. Like, but you don't get to just be a working writer because you want to earn it. That's harsh advice, but just knowing how the sausage is made, so to speak, you know, it's more likely than not that people will fail.
I have a question that before we jump in, although if anyone has questions, because in the chat, please feel free to start dropping them. We'll start asking Dan your questions for you. I know it takes about 20 seconds delay, so I'm going to ask you one more question. This ties into sort of what Catherine said and what you said, Dan, in terms of the sort of hierarchy of ways to find potential clients and query letters being, you know, cold queries being sort of near the bottom, but hopefully probably above Twitter, because at least you're getting a full email instead of 240 characters. But for those writers, and you had mentioned personalized, you get emails all the time, query emails that are not personalized. What, other than getting your name correctly, how does a writer stand out in a query and how do they personalize it? Like mentioning personal details of yours, personal detail, how much background of theirs do you want in it?
Sure.
Other than the log line, which needs to be fantastic, what should they have in their query to you?
Well, I would say, like, don't be like, oh, I'm a huge fan of all your clients. I mean, that's unrealistic, I would say. You know, I think it's like, hey, I listened to your podcast on Scripts and Scribes and your story really resonated with me, or I feel like you'd be a good fit. Like, okay, shows that you kind of have a sense maybe who I am. Or, hey, I'm a huge Dodgers fan. I saw on Twitter, you know, you tweet about, like, the Dodgers. That's super cool. Here's who I am. Like, just make one kind of reference that shows that you know who I am or what I'm about, right? Like, some people are like, oh, hey, I'm a cancer survivor. Like, heard that you had stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Like, congrats on beating it. You know, like, that shit resonates with me. It shows effort. And it also allows me to get to know them a little bit more beyond the scope they are as a writer. I think that is super helpful. Like, just knowing that, like, oh, okay, cool. Like, I could, if I'm working with this person, they're super talented, right? Like, this is something about them that, yeah, we could talk about beyond the scope of work. So that means something to me. But I just wouldn't be overly effusive. I would just try to be genuine. Show that you've made 5% effort, and it will probably help you stand out within a pack of, I don't know, hundreds of queries that come in a week, I would say. Like, you know, yeah. Something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll start asking some of the audience questions here. Dustin Melvin asked, what genres and formats do you prefer and feel you work well with?
Sure. I would say my background has been in features for the 8 years that I've been doing this. But I would say that I've gotten into limited series and with Derek's help, you know, some staffing stuff. But genres overall, I would say that, like, as it's tough to, like, sometimes separate, you know, my taste as a viewer, my taste as a manager. I'd hope there's an overlap. I like a lot of stuff that's ripped from the headlines, like biopics, anything that's based on a true story, or it's like, oh, hey, this was a Vanity Fair article, or this was in the New Yorker or whatever. That's usually something that I can gravitate towards and feel really good about. I think in the past few years, I've sold, I don't know, like 5, 6, 7 biopic type projects. I'd say anything that feels prestige would be released in award season is something like I'd hope to strive for. You know, but we look for what's good, right? So whether it's grounded sci-fi, something like Arrival, whether it's a rom-com, whether it's like a war drama, I'm really open. I mean, there's nothing that I wouldn't take on. I would say that I'm not that interested in, like, I don't know, over $100 million, like, fantastical fantasy type stuff. It just doesn't really resonate with me. I've actually never watched maybe more than, like, half an episode of, like, Game of Thrones. It's just not something that I like for whatever reason. So yeah, I think it's more about, are you adding something new to the conversation, whatever genre that you're taking on? Because I do think that great writing allows, even if someone's not a fan of the genre, if the writing is there, you can get people to be interested and read from start to finish. And that's, I think, a really special skill that I try to look for in potential clients. Convince me that I should be looking at this genre, even if it's not something I would normally gravitate towards.
Mm-hmm. And springboarding off that just really quickly, you mentioned big budget fantasy is not really your thing. Do you find that, because a lot of the bigger budget stuff out there is based on IP, right? Very rarely do you have a superhero spec come from nothing, and or a big fantasy thing come from nothing, a big sci-fi thing come from, you know, no IP, just a spec. Do you find that that's less appealing as a rep because you know it's going to be a difficult sell?
Yeah, I'm very mindful of, does the writing on the page justify the cost without having to consider, oh, this needs Chris Pratt, Chris Hemsworth, and Chris Pine to like fill out the cast, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if that's what it takes, the writing better be there so that if we have to make a call to CA, WME, and UTA to get that done, that they're actually going to give a shit. You know, we have a project that we're about to go out with that's like a World War II snow western, and it's like, huh, it's not for everyone, but like it justifies itself so that we know what we can do with it. It's not like the kind of thing where we're going to take it to 100 places, but there's probably 25-30 places where, okay, this can move the needle, this is something that would attract a certain type of director, a certain type of talent, and you know, how do we do it in the 40 to 60 space rather than the, oh, we go for the A++ elements and it has to be over 100 million, right? Like, right. Just being mindful of what strategic approach affords you the easiest path to move something forward rather than focusing on what's beyond your control. What can we control? We can control who we get it to and how good is it on the page. And I think, you know, we feel good about it. And, you know, is it something that like is going to change lives and whatever? No, but it's a movie. So, you know, we'll see. Yeah.
Good. Okay, the next question, Leo Ogan, hopefully I'm pronouncing your name correctly, Leo, asked, when you sign a new writer, is there an actual document that gets signed or is it a handshake agreement? And if the latter, how do you phrase that agreement to avoid confusion?
Yeah, I mean, if you're signing with an agency, there's usually agency like paperwork. And I mean, I don't know, because I've been removed for a bit. It's not even, I don't even think like a term, like at an agency, like, oh, you're signed for 2 years or anything like that. From a managerial standpoint, no, there's no contract. There's no set time. I think it's a handshake. It's a spoken agreement that we'll try to work together for at least a year and then reassess at that point. You know, I've had people that I've worked with for 3 months and it just didn't work. And we have parted ways. There's people that I've worked for years and, you know, just keep working together. I would say it depends on the company, but that's how we do it.
Mm-hmm. David Wales asked, let's see here. Scrolling here. What are your favorite movies from the last year or two, just to get a feel for if any of my projects would interest you? Good question.
Sure. I would say the past year has not been like my favorite. And now it's like I'm almost willing to take risks on things that are terrible because I just am starting to rewatch things rather than pursue new material. Things that I've loved in the last year. Queen's Gambit, I thought was excellent. I thought it was great writing. It was really fun. It elevated something in a meaningful way. In terms of like screeners that I've gotten that I've watched, like, you know, awards fair, you know, I really liked Minari. I thought that was really beautifully done. I thought Nomadland was really good. There's others that I won't comment on that I'm like, I don't really see it, you know. But what have I loved? Brandon Cronenberg's movie was really good. I forget the name of it, but it's David Cronenberg's son. He had this like fucked up, like, psychological thriller that came out in the fall that like was nuts, like absolutely nuts. I really like that a lot. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, my tastes, like generally speaking, beyond the last year, you know, my favorite show I would say would be The Sopranos. I think that's the best written TV show of all time. I really like The Wire, Curb Your Enthusiasm, you know, stuff that like probably more premium cable would be my taste on the TV side. Succession, I think, is an excellent show. I mean, I also like, I've watched Entourage in its entirety 5 times. It's terrible to admit, but like, I think it's fun. Even though, you know, it doesn't really hold up today in terms of the misogyny.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's a good sense of my taste. I mean, I'd say on the feature side, God, all these have like red flags now in terms of the people that were in it, but I really like Call Me By Your Name, Manchester by the Sea, you know, stuff that's heartfelt, character driven. You know, I want to feel something when I'm watching a movie. So,
right.
Oh, and Pain and Glory, I think, was really good.
Comic Book Steals and Deals says, good to see Dan or Daniel. I agree. It's good to see. It's always good to see Dan. Script Feels says, as a question for you, as an aspiring writer-director, would you recommend that I produce a YouTube vlog to self-promote, market my first no-budget feature?
No. I mean, no. I don't know. I feel like I don't need to really go into it. Like,
okay.
Focus on the project, not marketing the project. If the project is great, pieces will come together. Could that path work? Sure, but I wouldn't bet on it. It doesn't seem like a likely way to put something together, but I don't know. It's just my off-the-cuff opinion.
Right. Todd Klinger, hopefully I'm getting your last name correctly. Todd Klinger has asked, how much weight do you give to scripts with meaty roles that might attract big-name talent?
I mean, if the writing is there, great. Like, but I don't really think about that. Like, at that point, it's probably beyond my control. Like, there are certain projects that I know, okay, I'm going to need to attach an element or two to get people to care. It's not my favorite way of going about things. We have a project that we'll hopefully go out with in the spring. The roles are amazing. Like, they will be A-list level project. It's either going to be a grand slam or I'm going to be striking out looking, right? Like, it's probably going to be over $100 million. It's like, in an ideal world, a Robert Zemeckis or Steven Spielberg type director. And I hate to like say that because I've never said that about any other project, but this writer has cracked something in such a big way that that's exciting, that it's allowed me to perhaps dream a little bit more. But I also know, like, you know, there's only X amount of people that could do this type of project that gets it done. So I really don't think that way. Like, look at some of the projects on Netflix that have huge names. It isn't because those scripts are good. It's because Netflix overpays. They're going to make the budget bigger. They're going to throw, like, you know, more money at the talent. It's just, they can flex in that way, and that's great. But I would say, beyond anything else, does the script add something new to the conversation within the genre? Is it executive friendly? Are people going to care? Are people going to want to invest? Like, I hate the, oh, why now? Like, you know, that's something people say. But it's got to feel like it's saying something meaningful. That's how I approach things. Like, is someone going to want to sit down and invest 2 hours to watch this? Or is it just the lesser than version of what's already been done? And like, I very much avoid that. I don't want it to be like, oh yeah, it's Jurassic Park and Jaws and Titanic and it's in space, but it's not as good as any of those other movies, but I'm just going to try to upsell you on it. I like it when I can surprise executives and be like, holy shit, like, this is crazy. This is outside the box. This is totally what we're looking for, but not what we're even thinking about. It's like, wow, okay. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a hard bar to reach, but that's kind of what the bar is in my head.
Got it. David Wales asked another question. He's one of our great community mods. Says, you've had a life connected deeply to the sports world. How important is that to creating your client roster? How important are things like that to establishing a relationship with a writer?
Like, do people have to like sports to be my client?
I think it's more like have a similar connection or having a connection with you in some way. Does that affect their appeal to you as a client, and how important just in sort of a relationship outside of writing, not necessarily all the time kind of thing, but like, are you able to have a relationship with that person? And if so, does that make them more appealing as a client?
Like a yeah, company. Look, I would say that I'm probably more transactional than your typical manager. I mean, there are people that I represent that would I want to go have a beer with them? Yeah, for sure. Do we need to be friends? It makes it more difficult to have those types of conversations. Yeah, some of my clients love sports and we talk about sports, but like one of my favorite clients doesn't know anything about sports and we just have a good rapport and he's a good person and I just like him. He's a good human being. And I think that counts for even more than whether you like sports or not. I love sports. I can't say that I spend a ton of time watching sports these days. I read about sports constantly. I don't care if people like sports or not. I mean, it's like, I like a lot of things beyond sports. I like travel. I like going to bars and restaurants. I like going to museums. I like going to concerts. I mean, I would say that I have a lot of interests. So it's not, I'm not just like, oh, you're that Italian guy from Jersey that loves sports. Like, no, like, yeah, that's true. But like, there's so much more to me than that, that I would feel comfortable having conversations about a variety of different topics that go way beyond sports.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how to pronounce this name. It's THPTPTA. I'm going to call him TH. TH asked, I'd like to follow up on how you know you want to rep a client. You consider if you'd like to see their movie. In other words, if I wouldn't go to see it in the theater, I won't want to work on it for 2 years. Which I get, but do you ever feel an urge to broaden your horizons or take on underrepresented clients' projects, even if they're not something you personally vibe with?
Yeah, I mean, if the talent's there, absolutely. But I guess the initial question of how do I know when I want to sign someone? I mean, I would say it's an emotional reaction. Like, does the script linger with me? Do I keep thinking about it? Am I excited about it? Do I know where I would take it? Do I know the types of people that would be fans of the work? Can I visualize the process of it moving forward as an actual film or show? What elements about it are truly excellent? What shows the capacity to do something great beyond the scope of this project? I think I like to get ideas from potential clients. Hey, what do you want to work on next? That gives me a sense of, okay, they did X, what's going to be Y and Z. Do I feel like I'm excited about all the things that they're working on now and what they want to work on in the future? If the ideas really aren't there, if they're coachable, then I think I'm open-minded in terms of that process, but it's tough. We signed someone recently that's super talented in a particular space, but she's trying to make the jump to something else. And the ideas are not graduating towards that new space. They just feel like they're living in what she's comfortable with. So it's trying to equip her to realize why it's more what she's good at versus what she needs to be doing and kind of being, like a coach in that respect. And so given that she's open-minded, it's fun. It's a fun process to work with her as she strives to get better and move outside of her comfort zone.
Mm-hmm. AC Dead People wanted to know, what are some of your favorite unproduced scripts?
I don't know. I really don't know. I don't think like that, to be honest. I mean, for the longest time, it was Passengers, written by John Spates, and the movie ended up being pretty terrible, but I loved that script. I really did. There's actually a project that's coming out in the fall called Reminiscence that I read in like 2013 and flipped out for. But now I guess it's coming out. So who knows? I don't know. I don't like, as much as I love what I do, like I'm not a cinephile. Like I love a lot of things. Like I'm not a fanboy. I'm not like, it's a business for me. At the end of the day, I'm selling widgets. Sadly, like, I can't be like, oh, like if only someone wrote this or that. Like, I can't romanticize it because that's how hard it is. That's how much time it requires. That's, it's a lifestyle. So like, I can't, The saddest thing about my job is I can't turn it off when I'm watching stuff for fun. I criticize everything. And I think that speaks perhaps to my inherent personality. But like, it's very rare that I love something. You know, if something's 99% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, unfortunately, I end up in that 1% very often. I just can't. I can't not see the flaws, even if it is truly a great film that most people will love. Yeah, I don't know. It's I don't have a great answer for that.
I think you sort of have to as a rep, though, because if you like too much stuff and you're sending it out, you're going to be seen by execs and producers as not having really discerning taste, at least, right?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, look, especially being at a boutique company where I'm only as good as the projects I have to offer. If I start sending out real shit, it's tough. It is sometimes to get people to respond, it'll become even tougher, right? Like, I'll be honest, if I go out to 100 people, I would say maybe 95 will get back to me. There's five people on that list. It, you know, if I'm reaching out cold, that won't get back to me, especially if I have to go to like a really high level person for something. You know, it's easy to say no to me. I make it easier for them to say yes with the quality of the material that I bring to the market.
Right.
That's it.
Right.
I don't have the, I'm at CAA and I have 5,000 A++ level clients. So I can throw shit and you still have to read everything I sent to you because you may miss on a big thing. That's the game that gets to be played at that level. And hopefully, you know, they're still mindful of what they take out, but like, I can't really take a flyer.
Right.
And I'm very mindful of what the bar is. I've tried to see how close to the bar I can go. And sometimes it's like, hey, you maybe went a little bit too low. Ideally, I want to feel great about something when I take it out. Not, oh yeah, it's pretty good. Pretty good, probably won't cut it.
Mm-hmm. I was, and I've probably relayed this story before. I was a story analyst for a production company at Warner Brothers. And in a year and a half, 2 years, I probably read 600 or 700 scripts, my guess, somewhere in that range. And maybe another 50, 60, 70 manuscripts. And of that, I think there were maybe six scripts that I recommended and maybe 24 or so that I put a consider on. Everything else was a pass, pretty much. But I have to say that everything that I recommended and most of the stuff that I put consider on sold. They didn't sell to us. We didn't buy any of it. But they all, most of them ended up selling. And a few of them actually got produced. This was back in the day, you know, number of years ago when more specs were being bought and produced. Nowadays, it's much harder to get a spec purchased and produced in terms of like receiving a spec as opposed to developing sort of internally. But anyway, so no, I know what you mean about being discerning.
No, that's a great point. I mean, that's kind of what I did at Netflix was vetting very, very, very high level submissions where you could have said yes to everything. Like I'm talking, every project had an A-plus director or piece of talent attached. And it was like, no, it's not just about like, is it good? Is it, does it fit the Netflix model?
Right.
One of the projects that I loved was based off of like a book written by a Pulitzer Prize winner. And I like championed the fuck out of it. And they're like, nah. And then like Brad Pitt picked it up and it's like, well, I was probably right. So, That's the game. Like people have this misconception of, oh yeah, like if it's not a studio thing, we'll just sell it to Netflix. It's like, no, like it's harder to sell something to Netflix, you know, as an original. People right. have to like really distinguish the difference between a Netflix original versus a Netflix acquisition. There's a shit ton of crap that's a Netflix acquisition that they got paid peanuts for, if anything. A Netflix original, high, high bar. That I'm still figuring out like how to really crack. Like right. I know better. I literally know better. If it's not truly great, even like it's just not going to move the needle. It's so easy for them to say no.
Right. And to actually add on to what I just said, the 600 or 700 scripts that I had probably read in about 2 years, as well as the, you know, number of manuscripts, these all came from 95% of them. Came from agencies. They weren't just random submissions. They were
right.
agency submitted. So, or from management companies, you know, whatever. They weren't just cold queries and things like that. That they
yeah, yeah, yeah.
They were legit, you know. Okay. So Fee H and Script Feels both wanted to let you know that the David Cronenberg film was Possessor. Todd Klinger asked, what's your approach with a new writer with one great script, but it's really an awesome script?
Put together a list of maybe 50 places to take it to and blanket the town and sell it. I mean, and not just focus on the sale, but also can it lead to meetings? Can it lead to open writing assignments? Can it lead to ideas and IP being presented to the writer? You know, like the best outcome for a great project, yes, is the sale, is the sale, but also how can you further monetize the project so you can set up the next couple of years that it's doing? So like, yeah, you'll make the whatever it sells for, but then you're working on this, then that, and then people are thinking about you. And then there's a release in the trades, and then more people are thinking about you. Then an agency wants to sign you, and then you're off to the races and you have a viable career. Mm-hmm.
And what I would add is if you have only one great script, a number of managers I've spoken to said, that's fine. But what they would add is at least have two or three other really good ideas at the ready, because you will inevitably ask, well, what else are you working on?
Right.
And if you're not working on anything, that's a big red flag. So have at least a couple ideas, solid ideas that you're ready to go on, ready to go, like in your back pocket, that you have that list and you have the log lines ready to go. And they're, you know, so anyway, David Wales wanted you to know that he's not necessarily talking about sports, but just a connection together. But, you know, you kind of went into that. You just wanted to clarify. Leo Ogan says, I have a biopic about someone from the 1940s who I am a huge fan of. What set of criteria would help me validate the idea? How can I make sure Hollywood wants to get this made?
They probably don't, to be honest, just off of it being the 1940s, unless there's something. If it's someone obscure and it's period, it's super tough. I mean, think about like a lot of projects that have worked in that space. It's like, oh, Bryan Cranston was involved. Oh, David Fincher was involved. Oh, the Coen brothers. Oh, Tarantino. You can't use those types of projects as a good barometer. It's like, those were passion projects for people that people will spend money on, right? Like, oh, people are always like, oh, but like, why can, you know, the Coen brothers or Tarantino do a Western? It's like, because they want to. Like, you know, people are like, oh, Hell or High Water, it's such a great script. It's like, okay, but like, Taylor Sheridan was a working actor. He did Sicario first. That script had been sitting on the shelf. Like, think about the path for how something comes to fruition. It doesn't mean it works for an up-and-coming writer. You know, like, anything period is always going to be harder. You know, if it's not a huge name, if it's not like, I mean, look, like 1940s, like, you know, we've already seen a Jackie Robinson biopic, but like, it's got to be that level of stature. You know, is it a unique way into something that about World War II? Cool. That may help. But if it's just some randomish person that like, there's not a huge appetite for, that there's no IP based on, it's tough. It's going to be so predicated on the execution. And look, it's always going to be about the execution, but you're making it even harder with the other aspects of the script that need to be considered, because it's just not going to be as easy to get people to give a shit on the executive and producer side. Mm-hmm. It makes it easier for them to say no.
Dustin Melvin asked, what do you feel are your strengths when giving notes? What are the most common notes you find yourself giving?
I would say that I'm much better at character stuff than plotting. I think like I'm still really mindful of structure and things like that. I don't know. Like, I think it's my attention to detail, like really not just the, okay, the macro and micro of it, but what are ways that we can just make this script more visually appealing? You know, thinking about things that just, I'm very mindful of the reading experience, every aspect of it. You know, like orphans and widows and slug lines and page count and like grammar and like the best word choice, like really kind of using my skill set as an editor, not just as a manager, right? Like the best clients can get a script to at least very good. I think thinking about things both, you know, big picture, small picture, but not writing the script for them. I think that is the most important thing. I really try to think about how do my notes make the script better versus making it my version of the script. And I think that's something that's super important to be mindful of.
Mm-hmm. Script Feels says Passengers was such a fun script, and they wanted to know if that was the Lisa Joy script.
Reminiscence, yes.
This one says Passengers.
Passengers was John Spates, but gotcha. The other script, Reminiscence, was Lisa Joy, yeah.
Gotcha. Nathan S.M. Knapp says, any advice for comedy writers trying to get staffed? Is it best to write pilots and submit to contests? Is getting stage time doing stand-up or producing content?